Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with an attempt by a city council to shut down the Occupy movement through the courts. Joining us are the attorneys for Occupy Chattanooga, Scott Michaelman, who is a staff attorney with Public Citizen in Washington, D.C., and Chattanooga attorney David Veazey. We will discuss this first-of-a-kind suit that tries to force individuals to pay a county's costs for seeking judicial validation of its own law. Then American University historian Alec Linkman joins us, the author of White Protestant Nation, The Rise of the American Conservative Movement, and The Keys to the White House, a surefire way to predicting the next president. He has correctly predicted the outcomes of all U.S. presidential elections since 1984. We will discuss the fear gripping the Republican establishment that 2012 could be a repeat of the 1964 Goldwater blowout if the Tea Party radicals manage to show up at the Republican convention in August in Tampa with Newt Gingrich as their leader. Then finally, we will examine who the real Saul Alinsky was. Not the Saul Alinsky radical Newt Gingrich accuses President Obama of being, but the community organizer and political strategist who has been studied on the left and the right by Cesar Chavez, Dick Armey, Hillary Clinton, and the Tea Party, among others. Alinsky's protege, Nicholas von Hoffman, joins us. He worked with Saul Alinsky from 1953 to 1963 and is the author of the new book, Radical, A Portrait of Saul Alinsky. Joining us now is David Veazey, an attorney representing members of Occupy Chattanooga who are being sued by their local government. He's a native of Chattanooga and an active member of the American Bar Association, the Tennessee Bar Association, and the Tennessee Association of Criminal Defense Lawyers. Welcome to Background Briefing, David Veazey.
Thank you.
And I understand that what's happening down there is a first-of-its-kind lawsuit that seeks to force individuals to pay county costs for seeking judicial validation of its own law. That strikes me as being a little Kafkaesque.
Yeah, that's right. What happened was the county had passed an ordinance setting out new permitting regulations for county property, and they didn't take any steps to enforce it, but instead they went to federal court to get an opinion saying it's constitutional, but problem is they wanted the protesters to pay for it, plus the attorney's fees, and they actually hired one of the most expensive law firms in town to do this for them.
But what is this based upon? Who's arrayed against who here? It's Hamilton County against Occupy Chattanooga, but the Occupy movement is fairly, what would I say, amorphous. They're not incorporated. They're not like Bank of America. I mean, So give us a sense of what provoked this and why resort to this tactic.
Right. I don't think they put too much thought into who to name in the lawsuit. And you're right, it's not a legal entity. And they also named John Doe's and Mary Doe's. But I think they just want to get a green light from the federal court so they can go ahead and start removing people from the county lawn, from the courthouse.
And tell me about the demonstration itself that's provoked this unusual judicial maneuver on the part of the local council.
Well, they've had tents set up there and a fire pit for a few months now. I don't remember exactly when they started, but it's fairly small, probably a couple dozen. But any given night, there's probably only a few people sleeping there. But it's just become, from the county commission's eyes, it's just become a nuisance, and they would rather they just go away.
So they've come up with this ordinance, which they've taken to federal court, that forces the Occupy people to pay for their own court costs?
That's right. I think that's borders on insulting.
And have there been other means or methods to persuade them? And we had a thing here in Los Angeles, where Occupy Los Angeles negotiated with the police for a long time, and then they were forcibly evicted. So, a lot of people were very upset about what happened. But the long and the short of it is, at least there was some kind of negotiation going on here. This seems an extreme measure. What other steps have been taken prior to the council taking this step?
Well, there does seem to be a little disconnect between the law enforcement, the sheriff's office, and the county commission, because all along protesters have been working with the sheriffs, and they would make comments about, you know, their fire pit or the health and safety issues, and they would comply with them, do everything they would ask. So, you know, there really hasn't been any issue with law enforcement at all. It's just the county commission.
So, David Veazey again, an attorney representing Occupy Chattanooga, who are being sued by their local government. You went into federal court. Well, they took it to federal court, so you went in to defend the Occupy Chattanooga people. Who are the people that are being called Occupy Chattanooga? You said they don't even have names for them. They're calling them John Does.
Yeah, well, they have about five or six people that they named, but some of these people were active early on, and I know at least a couple of them never actually spent the night there, but these are names maybe they picked up in the media or elsewhere, and they had to sue somebody, so they put those names down.
Okay, so you go into federal court defending these people that the county's not even sure who they're suing, right?
That's correct.
So what happened in federal court?
Well, they filed their complaint for a declaratory judgment about 3 weeks ago, and we filed our response with a motion to dismiss this morning. So now we're just waiting for their response, and we expect to have a hearing in front of a judge to discuss whether it should go forward.
So why do you think Hamilton County went into federal court?
Well, I believe they wanted it to get a U.S. constitutional seal of approval from the federal court, and they couldn't get that from state court.
And they wanted a constitutional seal of approval that you can preemptively sue people and then expect them to pay the court costs?
Well, I don't know if that was their motivation, but that they wanted this to be, you know, seen by a federal court to be constitutional, so they can go ahead and start removing people.
So who is forcing the issue here? I take it you had the city attorney that you were up against, but who's behind this? Is it the county council? I'm trying to figure out what sort of political motive there is here, because it seems to be going well beyond, you know, a local ordinance.
Right. It's definitely the county commission is behind it. And we don't know what their motivations are. I mean, there is a sunshine law in Tennessee where they have to conduct all meetings in public, but they can meet with their attorney in private. So we don't know what particular motivations there are, if there are any particular commissioners behind it.
So in federal court, in your seeking to have it dismissed, what were the other side arguing?
Well, I mean, we don't know what their counter is to our argument that it should be dismissed based on lack of jurisdiction, but their complaint just wanted the court to say that their ordinance is constitutional. But our argument is that, you know, this is not the proper forum to decide that. The federal court can't give out advisory opinions.
And your clients, did they come to you, the Occupy Chattanooga?
Indirectly, they were seeking out legal assistance, and I just volunteered.
I see. Well, we're going to talk now with Scott Michaelman, who's a staff attorney with Public Citizen, who are also helping you with this lawsuit. When do you think you'll hear something about it? I mean, I take it that the occupiers are still camped on the lawn, right?
Yeah, that's right. Nothing's changed as far as that goes.
And the sheriff's not unhappy with them. It's the council that's trying to pull this legal maneuver.
Yeah, I mean, actually, the sheriff has said to the media that before the ordinance was passed, at least, that the Occupy movement was not breaking any laws and they didn't have any problems with them.
Right. Well, I thank you for joining us, David.
Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with David Veazey, an attorney representing members of Occupy Chattanooga who are being sued by their local government. He is a native of Chattanooga and an active member of the American Bar Association, the Tennessee Bar Association, and the Tennessee Association for Criminal Defense Lawyers. And joining us now is Scott Michaelman, who's a staff attorney with Public Citizen. He was previously with the American Civil Liberties Union and has taught at Seton Hall Law School, Santa Clara Law School, and the University of California at Santa Cruz. Welcome to Background Briefing, Scott Michaelman.
Thank you, Ian.
And we just spoke with David Veazey, who's handling the case down in Tennessee. where the Occupy Chattanooga people are to be evicted from camping in front of City Hall by the City Council, who've taken it to federal court, and then are basically charging the occupiers court fees to pay the county's costs, seeking judicial validation of its own law. And I mentioned it was sort of Kafkaesque. How would you describe it?
Well, I think that's a good adjective for it. What's really troubling about this case is the potential for local and state governments to chill speech that they don't want to hear by taking their political opponents to court. And the risk of a monetary judgment, as you have here, can be very dissuading for a group of people to speak out and speak their mind. Certainly not as violent as some of the police actions that we've seen across the country against Occupy demonstrators, but in many ways just as coercive.
And I take it that you've joined in because you see the bigger picture here, right? That this is a tactic that could be used, and it apparently is being employed.
That's right. Public Citizen became involved with Mr. Veazey in this case because of the broader implications, both for protest movements such as Occupy and for the potential to misuse federal jurisdiction as a political rather than a legal tool.
So they went into federal court to get the constitutional stamp of approval on this. What were they thinking, that this was a receptive federal court and somehow that, you know, it could go all the way to the Supreme Court and be validated? I've heard of this thing called Supreme Court shopping, which happened with that Second Amendment case in Washington, D.C., and also happened with Citizens United. So what's going on here?
Well, I can't speak to their legal strategy and calculations, but it seems clear that they wanted to try a new way of dealing with Occupy protests. We've seen a number of hostile state and local governments take action against protesters across the country in ways that have led to adverse publicity for the local government, particularly when the police are involved and when they precipitate confrontations. Here, certainly, there isn't the same kind of negative image for the county. The problem is that they're seeking to attack the demonstrators' wallets by dragging them into court and seeking to have them pay court costs.
And I take it that the sheriff is perfectly content to work with the Occupy protesters, and this is being precipitated by the council, presumably for what, political reasons?
It does seem to be more of a political type of lawsuit than a practical one. The on the ground, the demonstrators and the local law enforcement have been working cooperatively. When the local law enforcement officers have let the protesters know that a particular type of camping equipment, of fire pit, of sign is not a good idea or unsafe, the protesters have been completely cooperative in working out an accommodation. So this is not something that needs to be in court. And I think this is a striking example of how the First Amendment need not be at odds with law enforcement, that law enforcement and the freedom of expression can work together cooperatively without getting the courts involved, without heavy-handed tactics. But the Hamilton County Commission seems determined to make this into a political fight.
So the Occupy movements in various cities, they've had court battles over the extent of their rights. But the point about this lawsuit against Occupy Chattanooga, it's the first of its kind against Occupy demonstrators, right? Even though they don't even name these people.
Well, that's right. This is an unusual suit because instead of the usual case we've seen, which is where Occupy protesters might go into court saying the actions that have been taken against us by local law enforcement or by local governments are unconstitutional and we want to define the extent of our rights, it's a preemptive action against Occupy and an offensive action by the local governments dragging them into court. That's not something we've seen before, and we hope it that this case doesn't set a bad precedent allowing this kind of tactic.
Because you can't defend it on First Amendment grounds, right? Because they're not using the First Amendment.
Well, it's the question isn't yet whether whether the ordinance is constitutional. That's the question that the county commissioners are seeking to have determined. The problem is what happens when you take people into court in the first place, when there's no real dispute brewing, when the protesters and law enforcement are working cooperatively, and instead of waiting for an actual dispute to arise, you get people into court and try to make them pay court costs. So before we even reach the First Amendment questions, we have to talk about the use of the legal system as a tool to suppress dissent.
And I take it that the county commissioners have hired a very expensive law firm, right? That's what David told us.
You know, I'm not as familiar with the local attorneys, though I understand there's some prominent ones on the other side, but we're ready for that fight.
Right. Well, the point of that was to indicate that, you know, that there's a serious effort on their part, maybe to create some case law by the sound of it.
Right, and I think that would be a troubling precedent. It's fortunate. I think the law so far has developed on our side of the question that you can't that local governments can't march into federal court seeking rulings to determine the validity of their own laws, and I think that's a good rule that protects against this kind of action designed to deter protests by making demonstrators into defendants.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us here today and explaining this, Scott Michaelman.
Thank you very much, Ian.
Again, I've been speaking with Scott Michaelman, who's a staff attorney with Public Citizen. He was previously with the American Civil Liberties Union and has taught at Seton Hall Law School, Santa Clara Law School, and the University of California at Santa Cruz. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back talking about how the Republican Party is terrified that 2012 elections could turn out like the 1964 Goldwater blowout.
Before on another time around the wheel, I would probably know just how to deal with all of you. And I feel like I've been
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Alan Lichtman, who's a professor of history at American University, who studies both the American right and the presidency. His books include White Protestant Nation, The Rise of the American Conservative Movement, and The Keys to the White House, A Surefire Way to Predicting the Next President. His prediction system has correctly predicted the outcomes of all U.S. presidential elections since 1984. Welcome to Background Briefing, Alan Lichtman.
Thank you, Ian.
And what's your prediction? I know we've spoken about this before for 2012. Given the what appears to be haunting the Republican Party is the specter of 1964, when the radicals took over the party and made Barry Goldwater their nominee, and they got trounced by LBJ, and they don't want this to happen again with. The wild card Gingrich said they want to stay with the safe bet Romney.
Right. Think of it, the Republican Party, like this mom and dad, you know, whose daughter is dating, on the one hand, this nice, safe, boring family guy, and on the other hand, this wild and woolly philanderer, you know. And they really don't want particularly either one of them. So, you know, do they go with their fears or not? And right now they seem to be going with their fears. Better the safe, boring guy who might not give us much of a life, but at least won't break our hearts.
And do you think their prediction is correct, that if Gingrich gets the nomination, and it's looking less likely now, he's, I think, an average 12 points behind in all the polls in Florida, but he says, and he just said on CBS today, that he's absolutely determined to take it all the way. I frankly think he's not bluffing.
Oh, I think Gingrich will take it all the way. What in the world does the guy have to lose? You know, what is he, 68 years old? This is his last realistic shot. He hates Mitt Romney. He thinks Mitt Romney has lied about him, been unfair to him. But, you know, the truth is, you don't have to lie about Gingrich. There's enough there. You know, all you have to do is tell the truth. You know, as Adlai Stevenson once said, if the Republicans will stop lying about me, I'll stop telling the truth about them. But Gingrich has nothing to lose. Neither does Ron Paul. So why not take it all the way? A win in Florida does not guarantee Romney anything. He's still pretty much dead even with Gingrich in the national polls, and neither one of them can crack 30%.
But Alan Lichtman, to the question, though, of whether the calculus that a Tea Party radical right-wing
will
get trounced in the general, I mean, the mood of the country is kind of surly.
I think they will get trounced. I think, you know, generally, no matter who the nominee is, my prediction system that you talked about predicts an Obama win, but I do think the margin is likely to be greater with a candidate of the extreme right who carries all the baggage that Newt Gingrich does. But, you know, if you leave aside the personalities, you know, Romney comes off as more moderate, Gingrich as, you know, more combative and a wild man. In many ways, Romney has pitched himself to the right of Newt Gingrich in this campaign. For example, on the immigration issue. You know, you'd have to fall into the ocean now to be to the right of Mitt Romney. He's talking about crazy things like voluntary deportation.
Self-deportation, right.
Yes.
Which, by the way, you know, is what's happening in Alabama. And it's really quite nasty. The logic behind it is to make life so miserable for these people that they have to leave the country.
It's the way the South used, you know, back in the bad old days, used to deal with African Americans. You know, make life as miserable as possible for them.
So, again, I'm speaking with Alan Lichtman, professor of history at American University, who studies both the American right and the presidency. There is the power of the establishment is. In spite of this Tea Party revolution, it looks like, you know, the guys in the back room, in the smoke-filled room, are asserting themselves. And not the least of which, of course, is the enormous amount of money that Romney's able to spend on television in a very important key state that has lots of big television markets. And I'm just wondering how Gingrich is going to make it, because you know, the big factor in this election, I think, surely is the Citizens United decision, right? Unlimited money.
Unlimited money, you know, it's just poisoning and polluting our politics. But leave that aside for a moment. I think you may be overstating the power of the quote-unquote Republican establishment. You know, they haven't really been able to sell Romney. There's still a tremendous amount of grassroots resistance to this guy. And as we saw, you know, the more radical fringe of the Republican Party was perfectly capable of bouncing more moderate candidates and establishment candidates in places like Utah, Nevada, and Delaware. And the truth is, if they had a better vehicle than Newt Gingrich, if they had a right-wing candidate, say Mike Huckabee, who didn't have all the baggage of Newt Gingrich and all the lack of the discipline and all the, you know, both feet in the mouth disease, they'd be able to beat Romney.
And colonies on the moon.
Yeah, he's so flawed. And yet he's giving Romney a run for his money. Imagine a more cleaned up right winger. You know, I think someone like Huckabee would have won this campaign.
So are you suggesting, Alan Lichtman, that even if Romney gets the nomination and manages to, and Gingrich sort of runs out of money and runs out of steam, I believe the rules are written in such a way that the delegates are not so much apportioned on a winner-take-all basis. And is it possible that Gingrich could stay in this race and then do another battle at the convention and sort of refight the fight with all the Tea Party people showing up, yelling to the rafters.
Sure, we've seen that movie before. You know, Hubert Humphrey took George McGovern to the convention in 1972 with a big battle over the rules in the winner-take-all California primary. George McGovern held on, but it was a terrible convention for the Democrats. Bitter, bruising, nasty convention. You know, George McGovern wound up speaking in the wee hours of the morning. We saw Ronald Reagan in 1976 take the battle right to the convention. Now, he was a lot smoother and less nasty than Hubert Humphrey, but nonetheless, no one knew whether it was going to be Reagan or the sitting president, Gerald Ford, until the convention of 76. So we've seen this movie before, and absolutely it could play out this time, although given that it's kind of a two-person race, it's going to be a little hard to stalemate it.
Well, but as you pointed out, though, just fighting this battle, the establishment candidate has had to adopt a lot of the Tea Party platforms and positions, right?
Absolutely. It's remarkable. You know, we all knew Romney had moved to the right. But, you know, when you position yourself to the right of Newt Gingrich, you know, you're falling off the edge of the political universe. And you know all of this stuff is going to come back to haunt him in the general election.
So when Gingrich's national political director, Martin Baker, says the race is just getting started and they have a long way to go. I guess they do. Both of them do. They need 1,114 delegates, and there are 50 delegates at stake in Florida. And assuming Romney gets them all, that's still a long way to go, right?
Oh, yeah. Less than 5% of the delegates overall will be selected after Florida. It's just a tiny handful. There's a long way to go. And as I said, Gingrich has nothing to lose by taking it all the way. And Ian, we have seen this Republican nomination struggle turn on a dime. This is the most unstable political situation in recent memory. We've seen candidates, you know, rise and fall faster than the latest starlet in Hollywood. And we have not yet seen the last twists and turns of this race.
Well, that in itself has got to give the party power brokers heartburn, right?
Oh, yeah, the party power brokers, you know, such as they are, you know, absolutely twisting and turning in the wind trying to make sense of this and trying to stabilize it. The last thing they want is to waste all of their money on a nomination struggle. Plus, they have a lot.
Right. And their favorite candidate has a lot as well, Romney. Again, I'm speaking with Alan Lichtman, professor of history at American University. His books include White Protestant Nation, The Rise of the American Conservative Movement, and The Keys to the White House, a surefire way to predicting the next president. And his prediction system has correctly predicted the outcomes of all U.S. presidential elections since 1984. You have to admit, Alan, that Barack Obama is one of the luckiest son of a guns on the planet, isn't he? I mean, think about it. He ran in for the U.S. Senate in Illinois against a complete nutcase, Alan Keyes.
Right.
And then he ran in the 2008 presidential elections against this doddering kind of fool. the economy
had
crashed
on
his head.
He did have some pretty stiff competition in the primaries with Hillary Clinton.
He certainly did. I shouldn't have mentioned that. But it looks like this time around, if this fratricide continues, it's going to be pretty easy for him.
That's right. You know, the Republicans can fight. That's fine. You know, Obama won after a huge battle with Hillary Clinton, but the fight can come to the point where the party cannot get together after the battle is over, and that's the key thing. If the party can get together and forget about all this, it may not hurt that much, but it doesn't look that way to me right now.
Because what they have to overcome, three things. One, that Romney doesn't feel authentic, and that they just don't like him, and he hasn't been able to sell himself. Two, that he's a moderate compared to their, you know, the Tea Party's far right views.
He's the opposite. He's the lamb in wolf's clothing.
Right, and then the third one, he's a Mormon, right, which doesn't play well with the evangelicals.
No. That's three strikes.
Uh huh. So I guess then the money's going to have to talk, right?
Money always talks, but money does not decide general elections. You know. Both sides will have plenty of money. Obama will probably have more money than the Republicans. So there's no way anyone's going to buy this election.
Yeah, but Gingrich doesn't have the money. He's only got Sheldon Adelson's money. And presumably now that Sheldon Adelson and his wife's donations to Gingrich have gotten so much press, I imagine Adelson's probably not going to pony up another, you know, $10 million or whatever.
I don't think so. No, Gingrich lacks the money. He lacks the organization. He lacks the discipline. And he lacks a clean enough history. And given all that, it is a statement about how much they don't want Romney that he's still, you know, he's got four strikes against him, and he's still giving Romney one dickens of a race.
So, as an historian, Alan Lichtman, where's the comparison? We talked about 1964. Is that a valid comparison that the radicals came in? I can't remember who the Mitt Romney equivalent was.
Oh, it was a perfect Mitt Romney clone, Nelson Rockefeller.
Oh, there you have it.
Moderate Northeastern governor. In fact, they used to call the moderate Republicans the Rockefeller Republicans. And that was a battle for the soul of the Republican Party, which was a reprise of a battle they had 12 years earlier between the conservative Robert Taft and the moderate Dwight Eisenhower. That one was won by the moderate.
So the rich Rockefeller, who definitely does sound like a Romney clone, he couldn't buy his way into the presidency, or at least a nomination.
Very much like Romney, although more accomplished, actually.
Right.
But like Romney, you know, there weren't people ready to walk through walls for Nelson Rockefeller. There were a lot of folks who think he was okay and decent guy and, you know, a good moderate. But there were plenty of people willing to walk through walls for Barry Goldwater. And there are people willing to walk through walls for whatever right-wing candidate might crop up, including some for Gingrich. But nobody is going to walk through a wall, except maybe some of the very rich, for Mitt Romney. He's never going to inspire that kind of enthusiasm, and that's a problem.
And was there any of this sort of ironic populism that Gingrich has seized on, that this is a guy that doesn't pay his taxes and has millions of money that he's made from idle investments, while you hardworking blue-collar Americans have had to actually work for a wage and pay more taxes?
Not as much as there is today. There wasn't, you know, that kind of personal attack, not so much in 1964. There was plenty of it, but not at the same level as we've seen this time. I mean, the name-calling and the pettiness we've seen has, you know, reached almost gutter levels.
So then just to finish up on your surefire predictions here, Alan Lichtman, given that the system that you've created, the keys to the White House, a surefire way to predicting the next president, has correctly predicted the outcomes of all U.S. presidential elections since 1984, what about the possibility, though, of all that we've discussed here so far being moot, in as much as there are always these wild cards in foreign policy, and that things are quite unstable in the Gulf between the West and Iran, one doesn't know how much pushing that situation to the wall with these sanctions could result in some irrational behavior. And then, of course, the European Union is meeting right now in Brussels, and they still haven't got their hands around the euro crisis.
Ian, the world is a dangerous, unstable place, but it's always been a dangerous, unstable place. People always think, oh, some October surprise is going to turn this presidential election. Well, it hasn't happened since 1864. When the victories of Sheridan and Sherman turned around the Union fortunes and elected Abraham Lincoln. For 150 years, elections have been predictable long before the fall campaign even begins. Things can happen, but the truth is our presidential politics are much more stable than that, and the October surprise is simply a gleam in the eye of the media.
Well, I thank you for joining us here today, Alan Lichtman.
Anytime, Ian. Take care.
You too. Again, I've been speaking with Alan Lichtman, who's a professor of history at American University, who studies both the American right and the presidency. His books include White Protestant Nation, The Rise of the American Conservative Movement, and The Keys to the White House, A Surefire Way to Predicting the Next President. His prediction system has correctly predicted the outcomes of all U.S. presidential elections since 1984. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back talking to Saul Alinsky's protege about the real Saul Alinsky, not the Saul Alinsky radical that Newt Gingrich accuses President Obama of being. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Nicholas von Hoffman, a former Washington Post columnist and author of Hoax, Why Americans Are Suckered by White House Lies, Capitalist Fools, and the forthcoming A Devil's Dictionary of Business. His new book is Radical, A Portrait of Saul Alinsky. Welcome to Background Briefing, Nicholas von Hoffman.
Hi.
And clearly we need some clarity here, Nicholas von Hoffman, about who Saul Alinsky really was, given that Newt Gingrich at every possible occasion refers to President Obama as a Saul Alinsky radical. And with the Tea Party types, that sounds vaguely foreign, Jewish, subversive, unpleasant. You were his protege, as it were. You worked with Saul Alinsky from 1953 to 1963, and you've written about him in the new book, Radical, A Portrait of Saul Alinsky. So where do you begin to set the record straight?
I don't know where to begin. it's with so much with Mr. Gingrich. When you've made up so much, you don't even know which string to pull. Saul, of course, used the word radical as opposed to cream puff, somebody who wouldn't stand up and fight. He regarded liberals and conservatives of a certain stripe as basically people that you couldn't count on in a knife fight. So radical for Saul meant tough, purposeful, determined to take the point. When Saul organized people, the idea was not to win moral victories, but to get, jobs, houses, good roads, schools, etc.
So, and that's basically where he started, and he's kind of the father of all community organizers, starting in a very poor Chicago neighborhood of Woodlawn, up against the Daily Machine, right?
The back of the yards,
right?
The old slaughterhouse area.
Right.
The first community organization he put together, this is in the 1930s. The packing house people had defeated one union after another, and Saul had the idea that the only way that you could ever get the slaughterhouses organized was you'd have to organize the community around the packing houses, and then with that support you could actually organize the places, and that's what they did.
But when he took on the Woodlawn neighborhood in Chicago, he was taking on Mayor Daley's machine, right?
Yes. And he had a lot of fun doing that.
So
Saul always enjoyed the work. he was not a grim person.
Uh-huh. Well, he's apparently a very funny guy.
Very.
And, in fact, tell us about... I mean, he smuggled guinea pigs into the Joliet State Penitentiary, and what was the famous Buffalo Fart Inn?
Well, it was Rochester, New York. At that time, he was organizing the black community in Rochester, and this is in the era when Kodak was a mighty power. And the thing that they were most proud of was the Rochester Symphony Orchestra. So when Saul came into town, you know, one of his visits during the organizing drive, all the newspapers and what have you were out at the airport and looking panic-stricken as though Attila the Hun had just arrived. So they said, "What are you going to do, Mr. Alinsky? What are you going to do?" He said, "Well, I want you to know, you know, I'm not incendiary, nothing like that. I'm going from here to such and such church where our membership is coming together, and we are going to have a very large baked bean supper. And then after the supper, we're going to the Eastman Auditorium, and we're going to enjoy the symphony."
So, nothing, need you say more? So
he was just marvelous at letting the air out of stuffed shirts. He would have had such fun with Gnut.
Again, I'm speaking with Nicholas von Hoffman, a former Washington Post columnist and author of the new book, Radical, A Portrait of Saul Alinsky. And we're talking about how much Saul Alinsky has been appropriated by Newt Gingrich in this campaign, feeding all this sort of right-wing Tea Party frenzy about this President Obama being this this terrible radical, which he clearly is not. But Alinsky, you know, even though he's been... you know, pretty much, I guess he's a combination of Lenin, Stalin, Mao, all of the terrible things on the right-wing lexicon. He was neither a communist or a socialist. What was he?
No, he was, even though he was of a generation where a lot of people became Reds of fellow travelers, Saul never was. He used to say he had too good a sense of humor to sign up.
Yeah, or he couldn't turn on a dime like with the Hitler-Stalin pact, right?
No, absolutely not. He was not a doctrinaire man, because he was in the trenches and trying to win specific things. And when you're doing that, you know you're never going to get it all. Saul used to say, he said, "You're lucky in a fight if you're 51% right, but you have to fight as though you were 100% right."
So in the American lexicon, or pantheon, I should say, given the distortion from Newt Gingrich that claiming that President Obama is a Saul Alinsky radical, who stands out as a comparison? Would it be someone like Tom Paine?
Yes, he's got a lot. He loved Tom Paine, by the way. He's one of his favorite authors. He just loved Tom Paine.
Was he an atheist? Was Saul an atheist?
Was he an atheist?
Yeah, well, Tom Paine was certainly an atheist.
Yeah, well, I don't know, you know, I knew him all these years. I don't think we ever had a discussion about religion. It just never came up.
Right. So,
but he certainly, you know, when he was a kid, he was born in an Orthodox Jewish family, and they were observant, but he wasn't, you know, as an adult. But he had, I'll tell you, it was an interesting thing. He had some kind of magnetism in him that attracted religious people. It's quite amazing that everywhere he went, you had rabbis, ministers, and Catholic priests around him. There was something about him that they felt that he was a very spiritual man. And he had a 40-year, almost 40-year, relationship with Jacques Maritain, who in that period was the outstanding Catholic theologian. So it's not that he was deaf to things of the spirit, but he was too undoctrinaire, you know, ever to announce this or that.
Well, what I find extraordinary is how he was so... He's been studied in spite of Gingrich's effort to suggest that he's the source of this European socialist Kenyan cabal led by a Muslim, that in fact he has been studied assiduously by Cesar Chavez and Hillary Clinton on the one side and Dick Armey, the Tea Party, and that dreadful guy O'Keefe that did the acorn sting. So what is it about what he's telling political organizers of both the left and the right?
Well, I think one thing, there are two schools. There's one, you know, the social philosopher and the guy who hired and trained Cesar Chavez and people like that. There is also the writer who had some very cogent things to say about how you go about organizing. Unfortunately, what these people do, they all, particularly, they get a book, Rules for, what's it called? Rules for Radicals.
Rules for Radicals, right.
For Radicals. They look at it and they slavishly copy what he has to say. Well, that doesn't work. But what he can give you, if you are trying to organize lots of people, he can give you some insights and ways of going about things. But you can't, even though he calls it rules, you can't just memorize it and apply it. It won't work.
Again, I'm speaking with Nicholas von Hoffman, a former Washington Post columnist and author of the new book, Radical, A Portrait of Saul Alinsky. You were his protege. You worked with him from 1953 to 1963. He says of you, in all the world, my Nicholas von Hoffman, in all the world, my favorite drinking, talking, and thinking companion.
Well, we were very close. And even after I left him to go into newspaper work, we remained very close. And we talked almost once a week until he died.
And he died,
what? He was the best man at his wedding.
And he was pretty young, wasn't he? He died in 1972.
He was unfortunately very young.
At the age of 63.
I used to scream at him about what he ate. But...
Right. Well, and he didn't listen, clearly.
Well, he kept saying that if he got a heart attack, that's how he wanted to go, and that's how he went.
At the age of 63.
Yeah.
And in 72, that was still a pretty tempestuous year. He was...
Yes.
Very, I know he was very important to the Vietnam War movement, or the anti-Vietnam War movement, I should say.
He certainly was, and he was a ferocious opponent of it, needless to say.
So, Nicholas von Hoffman, one of the ironies about Saul Alinsky, and given the extent to which he's being framed in this debate by Gingrich as a sort of bête noire, because I think the subtext that the right-wing radicals and the Tea Party, and they frankly seem to have taken over the entire Republican Party, they can't hate Obama because he's a black man. That's not politically correct. But they can make up stuff about him that gives them permission to hate him, that he's not one of us, he's the other. He's, you know, he doesn't have a birth certificate, he's a Muslim, he's a Mau Mau radical and a Saul Alinsky radical, etc. But the other guy in the race who seems to be the establishment candidate, Romney, he, of course, is moving further to the right as Gingrich makes these outrageous claims. And it's great irony, is it not, that in the Detroit riots during the Vietnam War in 1967, Alinsky was invited to discuss the civil rights struggle with then Michigan Governor George Romney, Mitt's father. Tell us about that.
Well, they had two or three conversations, basically about what the right approach was. By the way, a number of Republicans, including Goldwater, approached him from one time or another. There was some talk about whether they could work out some sort of joint strategy, this or that, but the end result was, at that time, Romney had just left being the president of American Motors, and it seemed to me that the enduring thing was that Saul fell in love with the Nash Rambler, which was American Motors' car. But, it's very difficult with these politicians to get them in critical situations to make the kinds of moves they have to make. I mean, Goldwater talked to him about civil rights, too. And, Goldwater's concern, which has considerable validity is that these civil liberties, civil rights laws, can pose a threat to individual liberty. But Saul's position with Goldwater and a number of other of these people is, yes, you're right, but if you are going to oppose them or oppose this kind of thing, the obligation falls on you then to come up with something else that's going to work. The one thing you cannot do in the face of evil and wrong is do nothing.
Well, it's interesting that that Goldwater argument is being brought back around Ron Paul, isn't it?
Yes.
Yeah.
Well, it's always there, and it, you know, it has its place, but you can't do nothing.
So tell me a little about your book, Radical, A Portrait of Saul Alinsky, Nicholas von Hoffman. The book reveals a whole bunch of stories about politicians, bishops, gangsters, millionaires, and labor leaders, many of which Alinsky didn't want to talk about and make public in his lifetime. He gave you permission, did he, to spill the beans?
You know, during the time that all this stuff was going on, remember, Saul was not a man that was interested in moral victories. When he made a compact with a group of people in a community or wherever to work on organizing, it's because those people wanted certain things. So that, in that situation, you never get the whole thing. You want to get as much as you can get. You don't want moral victories. If you've got people who need housing, et cetera, they don't need moral victories. They don't need people to say, look how bad those other people are. They need houses. Well, that means all kinds of deals have to be made. Stuff has to be done. And some of it is stuff that you don't want to talk about until well after the fact, and a lot of the things in the book are well after the fact.
And what was his critique of Martin Luther King's organizational tactics?
Well, he admired King, but he basically said, you know, King couldn't organize a two-car funeral. I mean, that's He was a man of the spirit, you know, of the hurricane of the times, and anybody who was near the King stuff during those years, you know, who is a detached critic will tell you that it was a wildfire, but it did not have stable, enduring organization, which for some things you must have if you're going to get certain kinds of things accomplished. So, and Saul was very much aware of that.
Well, just in closing, Nicholas von Hoffman, it's, you know, pretty extraordinary given the range of people that have been influenced by him and have sought out his works, particularly his book Rules for Radicals. Hillary Rodham Clinton apparently wrote her senior thesis at Wellesley College on him. Have you ever seen the thesis?
Yes, I've read it.
What's it like?
Well, I think it's a very good paper for a young person who is a college senior. And, you know, you can't expect more than that.
Right. But do you think there's any evidence that he's informed her political life in any way?
Well, she'd be the one to say it may have, but I wouldn't feel comfortable making that judgment. I might say, by the way,
just in the last seconds here, because we're running out of time.
Oh,
go ahead.
I would just say we have much to thank Newt for, and in all of this business with Alinsky, which is that he's brought Alinsky forward again. And Alinsky's ideas, Alinsky's approach, Alinsky's idealism. And for that, we can be very grateful.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us, Nicholas von Hoffman.
Well, thank you for having me.
Again, I've been speaking with Nicholas von Hoffman, a former Washington Post columnist and author of Hoax, Why Americans Are Suckered by White House Lies, Capitalist Fools, and the forthcoming A Devil's Dictionary of Business. His new book is Radical, A Portrait of Saul Alinsky. So what do we learn on Background Briefing today? Well, we began talking about this stealth way to try and shut down the Occupy movement that's going on down in Chattanooga, Tennessee. The Occupy Chattanooga people are being taken into federal court by the city council, who have passed an ordinance which they want to have validated by federal law that actually charges the occupiers with court costs. So they're in effect preempting any kind of law by creating a burden on protest and making people pay for protesting. And if they could pull this off, it could have a very chilling effect on protest in this country, which is why I talked to both the attorney down in Chattanooga, David Vesey, and the attorney for a public citizen in Washington, D.C., Scott Michaelman, because clearly the tactic here is for cities to avoid the negative publicity and the police and stuff, tear gas and all that, by simply forcing people into court to pay court costs in advance of anything that they've done. It's an extraordinary abuse of the judiciary system. So it's something we should continue to watch. And then I spoke with American University historian Alan Lichtman about predicted the presidential outcomes of all U.S. presidential elections correctly since 1984. We were discussing the conniptions, the absolute fear gripping the Republican establishment that 2012 could be a repeat of the 1964 Goldwater blowout. He actually thinks that that Gingrich, in spite of his lack of money and organization, is going to go all the way, and that the Tea Party will stick with him. You know, they clearly, if they had found a right-wing candidate, it would have been a romp. But even with Gingrich and Santorum and Perry and all these guys running against each other, there's still enough of angry people out there on the Republican right who just can't stomach Romney. And Gingrich may well be able to take them all the way to the convention in August in Tampa, and create a kind of situation not unlike Goldwater in 64, which of course led to a blowout with a romp by LBJ. Apparently, the historian pointed out to us, Alan Lichtman, that there is an analogy there, because the guy, the Mitt Romney of the time against Goldwater, was none other than Rockefeller. So then I spoke with the protege of Sol Alinsky. Sol Alinsky's name's being bandied about by Newt Gingrich in a ridiculous way, but you know that's not surprising. He refers to President Obama as a Sol Alinsky radical. But Nicholas von Hoffman actually worked with Alinsky from 53 to 63, and he's the author of the new book, Radical, A Portrait of Sol Alinsky. And he was really able to explain who this fascinating man really was and what his activism was really all about. It transcended the left and the right, and people like Siva Shazer, Hillary Clinton, the Tea Party, everybody sort of tried to learn from him. Fascinating interview and a fascinating subject. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me, and I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.